You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or listen via Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or your favorite podcast app. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at Policy Podcasts.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Allen, and I'm the president of the Brookings Institution, and it is my sincere pleasure to welcome you to today's event, celebrating Brookings fellow Andre Perry's release of his new book, Know Your Price, Valuing Black Lives and their Property in America's Black Cities. Across Brookings' roughly 104-year history, Brookings has taken powerful positions on issues of race, equality, and civil rights. But today, these matters stand at the top of Brookings' priorities, and since becoming president of the institution, I've made this a presidential priority, both personally and certainly for the institution. Brookings has not only made an obligation to study these issues, but it's also a responsibility of the organization as well to ensure that we examine the intersection of race and policy, not just because we're an organization capable of impact and deeply committed to the public good, but also because we're an organization based in Washington, D.C., our nation's capital. For as much as Washington is a city of politics, it's also a city of great diversity and history. In fact, of the roughly 700,000 residents that call this city home, nearly half are Black Americans. And one need only walk past such sites as the Lincoln Memorial to remember the Great March and the immortal words of Dr. Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. It is a wonderful place to live and to work, and we at Brookings are proud to call it home. Yet alongside all of this rich history also resides a consistent lineage of discriminatory policies and bias, one that continues to impact the people of this city. And overnight, we passed a terrible milestone. More than 90,000 Americans have died in this COVID-19 pandemic in just weeks. For context, that number, 90,000, is more than the combined deaths of Americans in the Korean and Vietnam Wars combined. Conflicts that lasted years. Now, in numbers all out of proportion to their presence in the American population, Black Americans and other minorities have suffered terribly in this pandemic, laying bare the reality of their situation and their position and vulnerability in society. This suffering is extended as well to the sharp downturn of the economy and exploding unemployment figures and the devastating effects on small and minority-owned businesses. And even basic policies of dealing with this crisis have illustrated the reality in often detail, where just the essential of wearing masks and other face coverings have had overtly racist undertones and have hurt our communities. This is happening every day here in D.C., as well as in countless other cities such as New Orleans and New York and Chicago. What's more, besides robbing us of our precious lives, this disease has also highlighted other socioeconomic disparities and inequalities in education and in basic access. And still, we have seen the news of Black Americans who continue to be killed by the still simmering and brewing hatred of white nationalism and racism. Recognizing and realizing this reality, we must then center racial equity in the post-COVID-19 recovery, and we must ensure it is part of the renewal process. And certainly our efforts geared towards reopening America and the world have to emphasize these issues. Here at Brookings, our Metropolitan Policy Program, led by Amy Liu, has taken this need as a charge, working to ensure that at every level, local, state, federal, there is a more equitable recovery, and to take inspiration from Andre, that also includes a deep dedication to fixing the underlying policies and systems that prevent the equitable recovery from occurring, not simply debating around the issues. That's what making a difference is all about, and that's what this book is all about. So, ladies and gentlemen, with that, let me take a moment and introduce the author, Andre Perry. He's a fellow and a scholar here at Brookings, who has focused on structural inequalities and valuing Black assets. His book, Know Your Price, is a powerful and personal work. Andre opens his book with an examination of his journey from Wilkinsburg, Pennsylvania, to his work here in Washington, D.C. In Know Your Price, Andre highlights and spotlights those two cities, as well as four others, writing on their long overlooked assets, as well as the need for structural change. For my part, I view Know Your Price as an exceptional addition to Andre's already rich and comprehensive compendium of work. And he deserves our highest praise for this tremendous achievement. So with that, a brief reminder that we're recording and streaming this session live today. And if you'd like to ask any questions throughout the event, please send them to us by email at events@brookings.edu. That's events@brookings.edu, or through Twitter using the hashtag KnowYourPrice. Now let me turn the floor to Andre, who will offer his own opening remarks and introduce today's panel. And again, Andre, congratulations on this great achievement. It is a huge contribution to America. Thank you.
Well, thank you, John, for that inspirational introduction. And thank all of you for joining us today, hopefully from the comforts of your own home. I obviously didn't plan to release a book in the middle of a pandemic, but apparently there's never really a bad time to publish a piece on structural racism. I had grand visions of speaking directly to live audiences, debate critics, signing books, and hugging attendees. Instead, I've been forced to develop a special relationship with Zoom. As it turns out, you can stay connected while being socially distant. In spite of widespread bookstore closures and social distancing, my book has momentum. Know Your Price is already breaking records. For one, I learned that the word black is written more times in Know Your Price than any other book in Brookings Institution Press history. There is a healthy buzz and excitement around Know Your Price. And I owe a great deal of gratitude to my wonderful team. I could spend the entire hour thanking all the people who got the book to this point, but because of time, I'll only name a few. I want to thank my wife, Joya, and our children, Jay, Carlos, Robeson, for giving me the space to write this book. I also thank my wonderful work family, the entire Brookings Metro program led by Amy Liu. Working with Brookings Press, headed by Bill Finan, has been wonderful. Thank you. I thank my longtime Hechinger Report editor, Jody Vora, for her helpful markups. I send my deep appreciation to my colleague, Alan Berube, and CityLab writer, Brent Mott, for reading an original draft. I thank all the content editors for various sections of the book, which addresses housing, education, electoral politics, reproductive justice, gentrification, and of course, Black majority cities. Shout out to my crews in Pittsburgh, Detroit, New Orleans, Atlanta, Birmingham, and Washington, D.C. Thank you, David Harshbarger, for your research support, and Anthony Fiano for coordinating my community engagements. I also thank my writing partner, Jonathan Rothwell at Gallup, who along with David co-authored the study on housing devaluation, which anchors the book. Finally, I thank two people who are no longer with us, but are featured in Know Your Price. My adoptive mother, Elsie Boyd, and my father, Floyd Criswell. As told in my book, Ma Elsie raised more than a dozen children and informally adopted my biological brothers and me, largely because of the conditions leading to my father being killed in a prison outside of Detroit. For most of my professional life, I had to navigate a policy research community that deemed my mother, father, and our family construction as deviant. Since the Moynihan Report was published in 1965, researchers and journalists have continued framing poverty mainly as a function of individual choices. Moynihan offered a robust structural analysis, but he set a dangerous example by identifying a central problem as Black people not living up to white middle-class ideals. This falls in line with the white supremacist myth that claims harsh conditions in Black communities are mainly the result of Black people's collective choices and moral failings. We've all heard someone say the not-so-subtle dig, it all starts at home, suggesting if we could just fix that Black mother and father to be more responsible like white middle-class families, we wouldn't have any problems. Of course, white middle-class families are more disciplined and harder working. Just look at their wealth and education. if Black people are going to act well, Black, there's no need to pay them fairly or to invest in their businesses. More direct ways to make someone middle class, by the way. You're better off giving that investment to someone who has the credibility and capacity to show Black people how to behave like normal families. False narratives help normalize a hierarchy of human value that leads to an investment into whiteness. One of the major goals of this book is to show is that there's nothing wrong with Black people that ending racism can't solve. Underlying presumptions of Black people's unworthiness undercut efforts to invest in Black majority neighborhoods. There's a whole lot of programs and research that attempt to fix Black people, not enough focused on fixing structural racism. Until we rid ourselves of the underlying assumptions found between the lines of our research, policy recommendations, and reforms, we will always do more harm than good. Most Black people don't need to hear someone say overtly racist things about us when actions and outcomes tell us everything we need to know. When Roy Wood Jr., a correspondent on The Daily Show, was asked whether or not he believed President Trump had used the N-word in the White House, Wood replied, "I don't need footage of The Rock in the gym to know if he works out. Have you seen his arms?" Know Your Price identifies how precious Black lives and property are devalued by racism. By exalting the assets or strengths that are devalued, we can simultaneously debunk the false narratives that distract us from investing in those assets. If we can account for the associated costs of racism to individuals, then we can begin to properly restore lost value by investing in the people who have been penalized simply for being Black. The anchor study in Know Your Price found after controlling for factors such as housing quality and structure, as well as neighborhood factors such as education and crime, owner-occupied homes in Black neighborhoods are devalued by $48,000, amounting to a whopping $156 billion in cumulative losses. The point is, the value of homes in Black neighborhoods is much higher than they are priced. And isn't this true in other parts of our lives? But $156 billion is a big number. It's the reason why I say there's nothing wrong with Black people that ending racism can't solve. $156 billion could have started 4 million Black-owned businesses. Black entrepreneurs certainly could use this money as they are denied bank loans more than twice as often as their white peers. And when we do get loans, we pay higher interest rates. The loss of equity means that many Black business owners are less likely to have the financial cushion to weather economic crises like the one we're in now. During the Great Recession, about half of Black businesses survived, compared to 60% of white-owned firms. The $156 billion lost on racism should have helped municipalities fund essential services like education. We've known for decades that school funding, wealth, and racial prejudice are correlated with academic achievement. Schools dominated by students of color receive $23 billion less than majority white districts. This is largely a byproduct of an educational system that devalues Black communities through a financing structure that is based on local property taxes. Many education reformers ignore structural racism, saying it's too hard to address segregation and school financing system. But when reform is applied within the confines of inequality in Black majority cities like it was in New Orleans post-Katrina, we leave little room but to effectually blame Black teachers, parents, and school boards for underachievement. I saw this up close as a charter school leader in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. Approximately 10 years after the breaches in the levees, the Black teacher population dropped from over 70% to about 50%. Replaced by younger, mostly white teaching corps, two-thirds of the teachers who had worked in New Orleans before Katrina were no longer in the field. The erasure of Black teachers flew in the face of research that showed positive effects of Black educators on academic success. Black students who have one Black teacher by the third grade are 7% more likely to graduate high school and 13% more likely to enroll in college. After having two Black teachers, Black students' likelihood of enrolling in college increases by 32%. Unfortunately, hiring more Black teachers is something we have yet to try at scale. There's nothing wrong with Black people that ending racism can't solve. The values underlying the erasure of Black teachers are also behind why Black women can't buy or educate their way towards better birthing outcomes, in spite of their educational and professional gains in the past few decades. More Black babies die before their first birthday than all other racial categories. The mortality rate among Black mothers is 3 times higher than their white counterparts. These disparities exist even after controlling for education and income. In a 2017 study using death records, my wife, Joya, and her co-authors found that racial inequality in things like educational attainment, income, unemployment, imprisonment, showed harmful effects on Black infant mortality. When racial inequality in employment increased, Black infant mortality worsened. A decrease in educational inequality improved Black infant mortality. The devaluation of Black lives is at the intersections of race, gender, and occupation. Consequently, our solutions must be intersectional in nature. The issue of birth equity, like all the other issues presented in this book, is not an academic one for me. In Know Your Price, I detail the very personal struggle that my wife, who is a physician, and I had in trying to have a child when she was going through a professional crisis. In the chapter, Having Babies Like White People, I show that instead of restricting access to women's fertility options, an idea that the Moynihan Report gave life to, we must expand women's reproductive choices. The lack of wealth that the federal government facilitated should not continue to limit Black women's choices. Addressing the structures that cause inequality is a birthing option we have yet to try at scale. There's nothing wrong with Black people that ending racism can't solve. In Martin Luther King Jr.'s controversial 1967 speech that clarified his opposition to the Vietnam War, King spotlighted the hypocrisy of the United States fight for democracy abroad while actively suppressing the rights of Black, Brown, and Native Americans at home. King called for a revolution of values that included making a shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. Just as the U.S. government actively worked to normalize bigotry through policy, it can normalize investment in the people who've been denied wealth, dignity, and opportunity. Indeed, discrimination has serviced whiteness in public policy for so long, it has become an immoral entitlement, an iniquitous form of social security. We need an anti-racist policy agenda that normalizes support for the injured. Over the next few months, I will roll out an initiative that I'm calling the Valuing Black Assets Initiative, or VBI. The initiative will employ a virtual book tour to help communities mobilize around their assets amid COVID-19 recovery efforts. With seed funding provided by the W.K. Kellogg and Cerner Foundation, Black-led impact investment firms, CAPEQ and Impact America Fund, asked Brookings Metro to develop an index of target goals for the nation to advance Black businesses. We're determined to increase employment among 15% of Black businesses at a rate that will add an estimated $55 billion to the U.S. economy. The path to 1555 will convene business leaders, government stakeholders, and communities and provide them with the necessary steps to achieve this goal. In addition, Brookings Metro and the social entrepreneurship organization Ashoka will solicit social entrepreneurs in cities across the country in a $1 million competition to develop policy and market-based solutions that confront the problem of housing devaluation. The project will incentivize innovators who are proximate to the problem. We will seek to foster a new generation of structural innovations that remove the drag of racism on home values. Another aspect of the Valuing Black Assets Initiative is a collaboration with a polling firm Gallup. We will develop a survey to help measure racial attitudes behind asset devaluation. The survey will enhance our quantitative analyses and to further illuminate how prejudice devalues Black majority neighborhoods. Today is Malcolm X's birthday. There are a few quotes on my message board that have given me fuel on my writing journey. Malcolm once said, when a person places the proper value on freedom, there is nothing under the sun that he will not do to acquire that freedom. Now, I named the book Know Your Price after my favorite play in the whole wide world, Two Trains Running by August Wilson. In the main play, in the main character by the name of Memphis, is about to have his property seized by the city of Pittsburgh. The city offers him $15,000, and to which the main character Memphis says, I'm not selling my property for $15,000. I know my price. I got my price. I'm paraphrasing. But it's a refrain throughout the play. There's another character, Hambone, who paints a fence for a proprietor in exchange for a ham. He paints a fence, never gets his ham. Give me my ham. Give me my ham is heard all throughout the play. We're not sure if Hambone had mental illness before he painted the fence, but he sure enough went mad and eventually died. Now there's actually a happy ending. The main character, Memphis, got $35,000, more than what he asked for, and it's assumed he's getting the white rate. The moral of the story is clear. You must know you have worth. What I try to do with this book is give people a price to stand on. I wrote this book because I know my price. I look forward to working with those who know theirs too. At this time, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Brenton Mock. As I mentioned, he helped in the editing of this book. He's an incredible journalist for City Lab and Kimberly Crenshaw, the legal scholar who I've looked up to for years, who helped bring forth the idea of intersectionality, which runs through this book. And Kimberly is just a hero of mine, and it's a pleasure to have these two talk about Know Your Price with me. So Brenton Mock, I'm going to turn it over to you, who's serving as the moderator for this event.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks for inviting me to participate in such a great day. Congratulations on the launch of your book, and congratulations to the Brookings Institution, particularly for publishing a book that says Black more times than any other book in its history. I think that's worth giving a big up for. And certainly an honor to be in conversation with you, Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, Mr. John Allen, President of Brookings Institution. Thank you all. Let's just jump into it. The cities that you pick in this book, what you call Black majority cities, Pittsburgh, Wilkinsburg, Birmingham, Atlanta, New Orleans, explain the importance of these cities and why it's important that they remain Black majority and why you picked them for your book.
Yeah, the main reason I picked them is because I have a personal relationship with them. I don't think it's a coincidence that I ended up in many Black majority cities because I was raised in one. Wilkinsburg, when I was born, was about 50% Black, but it quickly became Black because of a majority Black because of white flight, something I talk about a lot. But in Wilkinsburg, I had all the assets right in front of me. I had a library, I had a university around me. I had people working in a commercial corridor. It was a great place to live, and it was a supportive place to live. It wasn't until I entered other spaces, namely college, and that's where I actually learned about the Moynihan Report, where people did not see that my town was worthy. So for me, in my professional career, I tried to put myself as much as possible in places that supported me. And so in terms of my professional advancement, many of these cities were instrumental in my growth because there was an overall feeling of support for me. But Detroit is a little bit different. As I mentioned, my father was murdered there, but my Detroit, there was a lot of exchanges between Pittsburgh, Detroit, Cleveland. My father was part of that. He would go back and forth between cities because of work. And so I have, certainly I grew up in Pittsburgh, but my family's from Detroit. And so there, as many families are. So that's the connection there. But the other is more about professional connections more than anything else.
Great, great. This question is for both of you, but we're going to start with Dr. Crenshaw. You've probably heard Andre mention once or twice that there's nothing wrong with Black people that ending racism can't solve. Wanted to hear from you, Dr. Crenshaw, do you agree with that? And how does that apply in this current COVID pandemic? Like, what are some of the structural racism issues that are leading to some of the racial disparities in COVID cases that we're seeing today? And how could the absence of racism, make the outcomes of this pandemic different?
All right, then. Thank you, Brenton. And I'd also like to thank Andre for inviting me to this important conversation. I'm really pleased to be part of your book launch. And not only am I excited to be in conversation about a book that uses the term Black more than any other one in history, but also capitalizes Black. And I hope many other publishers take note and follow accordingly. The other thing I want to do before answering the specific question is identify my roots in relation to yours, Andre. So I grew up about 90 minutes from where you grew up. I grew up in Canton, Ohio.
Oh, wow.
Which is just over the border. And so much in your book was recognizable to me. Now, Canton, Ohio isn't a majority Black town. And at the same time, the role of urban renewal, the role of highway development, the role of basically Black removal as a way of decapitalizing Black wealth is very familiar to me. I grew up watching my mother struggle to hold on to an apartment building that her father had left to her, which eventually was taken. She was given pennies on the dollar for it. The house we moved to, which was one of two Black families in the neighborhood, of course, became eventually an all-Black neighborhood. The home that I still own is devalued in relationship to the same house on the white side of town. So much of the story that you tell in personal terms is one that I found myself nodding my head to many times. And I saw, your father going, between Pittsburgh and Detroit, and I knew he was sort of coming through, Canton on that trip. So it was very satisfying read for me, and I appreciate your inviting me to do it. I think what I would want to bring to the conversation about structural racism and eventually link it to this COVID moment is, frankly, the role of law in making it difficult to not only see the devaluation that has been the product of decades of structural inequality, but also making it such that the expectations of whiteness, of privilege, of property associated with that, not only are naturalized, political efforts against policy efforts, and dare say against, I think, well-positioned projects like this, have a fuller understanding of the role that the law has played, both in maldistributing opportunity, but also in repressing the ability of majorities that have sometimes come together to do something about this, using rights of whites as the reason why it can't be done. Thus, we have that understanding, then the biggest part of what we might be able to do can't get done because the courts stand in the way. So I want to just disrupt, I think, one of the dominant frameworks that has emerged in this post-racial moment. And that is that we are in a post-civil rights moment. We are in a post-reform moment, that all of these problems are the after effects of a reformist agenda, just the things that are left over that need to be dealt with, as opposed to these are ongoing continuous dimensions of a white supremacist framework that was created and reinforced by federal policy. And it was explicitly so. So Andre, you mentioned in your book the creation of suburbs through federal housing policy. You mentioned in your book the GI bills that made it almost impossible for Black GIs to take advantage of veterans programs that in turn were precisely those programs that created the white middle class. This now has become naturalized. It's just the fact that suburbs in which white people are located are associated with the good things in life, and the communities in which Black folks are situated are associated with many of the pathologies. That's a product, as Moynihan then helped to frame, of family structures, of cultural choices, against a structural backdrop. And the basic way now that we have come to assume that we can address this is not through wealth transfer policies, not through intervening in ways that disrupt these patterns, but intervening in the repair of people, in repair of their families, in repair of their choices, in repair of, I call it, their gendered relationships. This is all made possible in large part because the Supreme Court has come back in response to something that Martin Luther King said, and I want to mention this because John Allen started with that amazing speech at the March on Washington, for which we all know the main thing that gets circulated in our consciousness is the idea of we should be judged by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. The thing that I want to lift up here for us to really take into account is not that passage, but the other one, where he said, we've come to cash a promissory note, right? A check that was given to us that's now a bounce check, right? What was that about? It was about a society in disrepair. It was about a debt that had not been fulfilled. It was a debt that is reflected and amplified throughout your book. It's a debt in terms of the devaluation of our property, the devaluation of our lives, the devaluation of our families, our education, the devaluation of our very lives to be. So that was what his speech was about in 1963. He put that on the table. What came back to him two decades later from the Supreme Court was what Antonin Scalia said, which is, there is no debt. We have neither a debtor race or a creditor race. What we have is the American race. And all of these inequalities that you all are talking about, that you're making part of structural racism, that's got nothing to do with the law. That's got nothing to do with inequalities that need to be corrected. That has been taken care of. So this deficit that you're talking about is a deficit that's been recognized by Martin Luther King. It's been repudiated by the Supreme Court. And as a consequence, our ability to really do something about that debt within the confines of the Constitution, as our court has articulated it, is limited unless we take back a notion of civil rights that includes dealing with this debt. And we can't do that unless we take up questions of law and questions of the court. So everything else, I think, kind of flows from that. The disproportionate effects of COVID comes from that. The disproportionate impact of unemployment comes from that. The disproportionate loss in wealth in housing from 2008 to now comes from that. So if anything, I want to leave with an urgent plea that we take up law in a far more critical way in our policy discourse, in our policy itself. And that's the first, and the second one would be patriarchy, and I'll talk about that in a second.
You know, and the only thing I'll add to that is that when I look at who received, who benefited from the CARES package in terms of the PPP loans, and people, you know, are put.
Andre, posting, I'm not hearing you. Oh,
can folks hear me? Britton?
I can hear you.
Okay, so I'll just go on. Okay. As it pertains to the CARES Act and who received PPP loans, last time I checked, 95% of businesses, Black-owned businesses, did not receive that subsidy. No one should be surprised by that. Again, when I talked about working within the confines of inequality in education, the same thing applies to economic development, same thing applies to business development. If we're going to work with the same economic development organizations, the same structures within government, the same use the same practices, you're going to get the same result. And so at some point, we need to work with a different architecture, you know, that we got to dismantle this stuff because we keep trying to work within this framework of inequality, tinkering at the edges, trying to use technology or technocratic means to improve things. No, these systems produce inequality. In housing, it's clear. In reproductive justice, it's clear. If we really wanted to save women's lives, we would eradicate the economic discrimination, the employment discrimination, the housing discrimination, the criminal justice discrimination. These things are so connected to our well-being that it's impossible to not see that. But we need to make these connections between these macro level injustices and what happens on the ground. But we keep resorting to this false narrative of moral failings as the reason why we don't support businesses, we don't support students, we don't support teachers. You know, these things are just this false.
That everything you just said, Andre, it actually reminds me of a quote, Dr. Crenshaw, that you gave me about 4 years ago when I interviewed you and Eve Ensler. It was about a report you put out. It was the Say Her Name report. But you gave me this quote. It was a great quote. You said, it's kind of like the plantation overseers are killing us. So let's give the overseers an implicit bias training instead of just getting rid of the plantation. In this COVID pandemic, I mean, we can start with you, Andre. Because you were talking about how we got to do this, a whole new architecture, right? We can't just tinker around the edges. What are the kinds of institutions, what are the plantations that we just need to completely get rid of, do over, in order to get closer to this goal of achieving racial equity?
Well, you know, what's interesting, I was not surprised by what happened in terms of the business loan, because I was in New Orleans at the time. And if you said FEMA and the SBA to a large crowd, you might get something thrown at you at the time. It's clear that if government needs to distribute funds either from tax returns or during emergencies like this. Why do we need banks in the first place? Why do we need why can't the government have government-sponsored savings accounts, checking accounts in the first place? I'm happy to learn that they're going to distribute some of the next round of payments with a prepaid card. However, the entire system there is set up for failure, that it doesn't address the banking issues that occur and that are present in Black communities. So we have to do something about that relationship between the federal government, the Treasury, and distributing funds directly to people. There's no need to go through banks that have shown not to be friendly with Black residents. I'll stop there, but it looks like Kimberly's having some trouble maybe.
Okay. Well, let me move on to the next question while they figure that out. So in this COVID pandemic, Dr. Andre, I'm going to call you Andre because I know
you can call me Dre. Most people call me Dre.
Dr. Dre, yes. So what are the kinds of things, what are the, in terms of Black properties and Black assets, how is the COVID pandemic threatening to possibly further devalue Black neighborhoods, Black assets? What should we be watching for?
Oh man, there's clearly going to be credit tightening. And of the folks that really do need credit at this time is Black folk. I'm a big fan of those legislators who said, hey, let's suspend not look at credit scores for now for a period. And let's not punish people, at least for going into debt. After the last recession, you saw Black businesses not survive at a higher rate. And it's because they had to go into debt because they didn't have the kind of wealth that other folks had. Again, all businesses are struggling at this point. But when you really don't have wealth to lean on, you're going to go into debt very, very quickly. So, you know, I've been pushing that we have got to figure out ways to get lines of credit to people in businesses or that have businesses in devalued areas. Because another study that my colleague Jonathan Rothwell and I did, we examined businesses in Black communities and we scraped Yelp data from across the country, comparing those in Black neighborhoods and white neighborhoods. And we controlled for spending power, we controlled for education and a lot of other variables, just like in the housing report. And what we found pretty much astounds that businesses owned by people of color in Black neighborhoods actually score higher on Yelp than their white counterparts, but they get less revenue. Now, what's interesting about this COVID moment that people are now ordering out and they're ordering from these Black businesses because they don't necessarily have to go in to the neighborhoods. Now, our elders used to say all the time, our ice is just as cold. They use the term, our ice is just as cold, to essentially say you should not bypass quality or you're going to distort the market in a way that's going to suppress the economic growth of the residents in it. And so what I've been saying, hey, we've got to figure out ways to use a racial equity lens to distribute these loans to Black businesses because they're the ones that need it most because of the past injustices. You know, COVID doesn't discriminate, but clearly our past policies have. And so to a framework that recognizes that disparity in injury would be called for in these cases.
Dr. Crenshaw, I see you just returned. I'm glad that we didn't lose
you. I was watching, not yet hearing, but it looks like it's been a great conversation. My apologies. Of course, the computer would decide today that it doesn't want to work. So I'm glad I'm back on.
It's a conspiracy. They don't want us to have this conversation. But the question I posed to Andre, in case you wanted to chime in, I was asking about how this COVID pandemic might further devalue Black properties, assets, neighborhoods. So what are the kinds of things we should be watching for, especially from a legal standpoint, we can kind of get in front of?
Well, you know, I think from what I heard, Andre was pretty comprehensive in that. I will add one other economic dimension to it that I think really bears a lot of attention. And that is, of course, you know, the disproportionate death for Black people is going to lead to disproportionate economic ruin for many Black families. I mean, even before COVID, death to Black families is catastrophic economically. We are least likely to be prepared. We are least likely to have resources set aside for final expenses. We are least likely to see any significant wealth transfer happening at the time of death. I think even before this moment, it was fairly clear that we were moving into a period in history where we were going to see one of the greatest racially disparate transfers of wealth Historically, I think this is going to hasten that disparity. And unless we are cognizant of that, I think the economic consequences that are measured will not include this particular disparity. So I would really strongly urge that we look deeply into the racialized disparities in death and roll those data into our understanding and our ability to track the catastrophe that COVID will be to Black people economically. And that's, of course, only just one piece of the broader catastrophic dimension of this moment.
You know, and I just wanted to add, when King said that we need to make a shift from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society, you see that in the reckless way we're trying to reopen this economy, that Black people are considered essential, but they are also replaceable labor with this rush to open in areas where Black death is on the rise. And so, you know, King really was prescient, because the same issues are at play. When you reduce Black people to labor, there's nothing more devaluing than that. And it goes back to our history with slavery, that we're constantly being devalued for our work, for our labor, but we're not asked to be someone's neighbor. And that has to end.
Yes. And if I could just put a point on the essential but dispensable sort of contradiction being deeply historically situated, that is the story of how we have made the conditions of America's possibility possible. I mean, stolen labor is what is the cornerstone of American wealth. It still is the cornerstone of American wealth. And at the same time, having created that essential condition of possibility, we were also disposable within it. That is a relationship that has not changed significantly throughout history. There's another dimension, I think, of that relationship that we can see historically and bring forward to this moment. Convict leasing, in some ways even worse than slavery, in that no one really had an investment in the laborers, and one could use the criminal justice system once we completely extracted all labor from a Black body by just going out and getting more. That's the sort of the history of criminalizing a population in order to extract maximum value from them. This is part of what the new Jim Crow helps us understand, and we bring it to this moment where, you know, one of the groups that is most vulnerable in this COVID moment, of course, are people in confinement, primarily people in custody. Not only are they being made vulnerable by the inability to practice social distancing, in some prisons, prison labor is being used to produce the actual products that others are using to maintain their safety. One can't get a closer connection between a past in which Black bodies were used to produce but not able to actually enjoy the fruits of their labor to this moment where they're used to produce safety in conditions in which they are the most unsafe. These are continuing dimensions of a history of devaluation.
You know, throughout all of this, we've been talking about racial disparities, whether it's the property valuations or the COVID pandemic. We've been talking about how it affects African Americans as if these things affect Black men and Black women equally. And we know that they don't. And we know that Black women, especially in this COVID moment, they are overexposed because of where they work, in the health professional fields. In terms of all of the various ways that they are having to deal with this kind of moment. But can we kind of talk about how Black women's lives are being valued in this moment, and how we can kind of uplift them and make sure that they are getting the proper value right now?
Well, you know, for me, the reason why I had a Black woman on the cover is because I quickly saw that even from a personal level, but also from an academic level, it's been Black women who've seen how all of these things come together to really devalue their income, their very life. And that's one of the reasons why I put the chapter in there on maternal mortality, professional status. Black women are doing everything asked of them that to achieve the American dream. But particularly during times of crisis, we find ways to not invest in them. You know, there's a chapter in on electoral politics where I'm blanking on the chapter title. It's for the sake of America, elect a Black woman president. And I talked about how Black women are being elected in all of these different cities, some of which are not Black majority. You have a London Breed, you have Ayanna Pressley, you know, at the federal level, all Black. But yet when it comes to these high stakes elections, we don't invest in Black women till the last possible second. You know, and you see this in every field, in education, where the leadership disproportionate number are teachers compared to leaders. You know, you see this, as I said, in electoral politics, you see this in income. You know, I see that devaluation starkly when you look at women's outcomes. So that's why I put a woman on the cover, because in so many ways, they are the cover of what devaluation looks like in public.
Well, and I couldn't agree more with everything you just said, Andre. And I guess what I would want to also do is play it back before this COVID moment to find moments of devaluation that actually shape not only mainstream policy about poverty alleviation, mainstream discourses about culture of poverty, justifications for inequality, but also ideas that circulate well inside the dominant parameters of even anti-racist mobilizing in politics. So, Andre, I think in the very beginning of the book, lifts up how the Moynihan sort of framework has hobbled efforts from the very beginning to see the structural dimensions of Black inequality, and in the end of the day, at the end of the day, ushered in and affirmed a focus on Black family relations as an important site of disrepair that would have to be fixed if Black people had a chance of equality. And this disrepair framework was in itself a moment of devaluing Black women. The problem with the family was that Black women, you know, were too powerful. The problem with Black employment was that Black women worked too much. The problem with the Black community was that because of Black women's perception of strength and capacity to be workers, to be leaders, that was seen not as an asset to Black communities. It was seen as a problem. So great was the problem that Moynihan advocated that Black boys be taken out of these families and sent to military school so they could learn how to be proper men. So this idea that gender disrepair is at the core of so much of what's going on with Black inequality is a moment of not valuing Black women for their worth. So what is the upshot of this? The upshot of this is that the ways in which our structure makes Black women disproportionately poor for choosing to have children, which makes Black women disproportionately without wealth because of the limited job options that are available to them, that blames them for the under-resourced tax base that their low income supports in isolated cities. rather than attacking the structural dimensions of that, many of our discourses attack them and make it seem as though the problem that they represent gets fixed, not by dealing with the contours of their lives, but by making more marriageable Black men to come and rescue them. Now, I'm all for the idea of including the economic opportunities for everybody, but to say that Black women's well-being can only be advanced by increasing the marriageability of men in their lives or not in their lives is to engage in a trickle-down assumption about racial politics, racial equity, that no other community is embracing or having to deal with. We're in a time where people are rethinking gender roles across the board. Why is it that Black people are the only group for whom conversations about inequality rest on Black women not being proper women and Black men not being proper men? We shouldn't accept these frameworks, whether they come from the right wing or, honestly, whether it comes from a program called My Brother's Keeper. These are the challenges of dealing with the contemporary articulation of Moynihanism.
Woo! You know, why you gotta get on that My Brother's Keeper? Why you gotta
do
that?
You know, you said you wanted something to disagree about, maybe we can have a little debate.
No, I completely agree with you, and I'll say it in a different way. That, you know, one of the things that I used to hate as an education leader, when people used to say, if we could only fix the school, if we could only get the school right, everything else will solve itself. The education is the civil rights issue of our time. And it was predicated on improving teacher quality. Mm-hmm. That somehow Black teachers were the problem. After, you know, years of decades of divestment, decades of abuse, a structural system that does not produce or distribute resources equitably, yet we're in a field where Black women are holding education down in many
sense.
Holding it down. Any kind of reform that leads to a reduction in Black women in any field is not a reform. It's the same old remix of same bad policy. You know, and so one of the things I look for, whether or not something is working, did it hire more Black women? That to me is a concrete sign that something is of value. And that, you know, and that includes research. You know, did you include a Black woman in this project? Can you look in, and I challenge myself on this. I have to look at my book and say, how many Black women did I cite? Did I uplift? How many women's issues did I put to the forefront? You know, we go through every day in terms of research, disparaging Black women, disparaging Black communities all day long. And so we're part of that problem too, including me. And throughout the book, folks will read, you know, I straight up apologize at parts because people like me need to. We need to atone and we need to model, hey, we were wrong. We were, when I fired principals in New Orleans, I did not have a positive view of Black women at that time. You know, so I had to apologize for that. And many of us still have to recognize when we don't include Black women. I can't say enough, if you go to any school, I live in DC. If I go to a school and I don't see Black women teachers, something is wrong. If you can't find a Black woman teacher in DC, something is wrong. I mean, completely wrong. So I'm gonna leave it there.
And it looks like we have 2 minutes left. I'm so sorry. There were some questions from the audience I was supposed to get in, but I was so caught up with church that I forgot to go to the congregation. But now with these last moments, I mean, I guess it's time for you to get to deliver the benediction, Andre.
Oh, wow.
Closing thoughts. Yeah.
You know, I look back on this and for me, this is an honoring of my family. And I was raised with brothers and sisters who were not my blood relatives. And I honestly don't look at sort of genetics as my tie to people. I look at it in terms of our bond, our work together, our play together. And so I'm looking forward to expanding my family in different cities all across this country, folks who know their price and are willing to do what it takes, even if it means going crazy and dying, to elevate the value of Black people. For me, this is about an investment in Black folk. If there's anything that you should get from my book, is cut the check, invest, get resources to Black folks, because they've been denied resources in the past. But this is an honoring of family, so I'm happy and honored to just represent my family moving forward. And that's it. Well, I want to say thank you for signing in, everybody. And I look forward to getting your comments about my book. Go get Know Your Price. You can get it anywhere, but try to get it from a local seller. It's available online stores or wherever stores are open. So thank you for having me.
You can read an excerpt of his book in citylab.com.
That's exactly.
Citylab.com.
Go to CityLab, get an excerpt, get a taste, and then go buy the book. All right. Take care, everybody. Bye-bye. Thanks. Thank you, Kimberly.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.